Hi. Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'm Ryan Schaefer. I'm the editor-in-chief of the Sports and Entertainment Law Journal. Introduce Guy Carmi. Guy is a doctoral candidate here at UVA, graduated from the LLM program last May, and he's writing his dissertation in the field of comparative constitutional law under the supervision of Professor Robert O'Neill. Guy is a member of the Israeli Bar Association. He graduated from 2003 from the University of Haifa Law School. He's worked at one of Israel's largest firms and also clerked for Judge Stemmer at the Bet Mishpat Mechotzi, which is roughly equivalent to the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. In Israel, Guy has held assistant teacher and research assistant positions at Israeli law schools. His latest publication was in the spring issue of the Virginia Sports and Entertainment Law Journal, dealing with comparative notions of fairness and entitled Comparative Notions of Fairness, dealing with the fairness doctrine in the United States and Israel. That article is available at 4VASELJ275 for those who are interested. Without further ado, Guy Carmi.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to thank all of you for coming. I know it's sunny out there and there are other concurrent events, so thank you for your trust. Thank you for Ryan Schaefer and for the Virginia Journal of Virginia Sports and Entertainment Law Journal. Thank you for the J.B. Moore Society and the Jewish Law Student Association for sponsoring this event. I hope to conduct this talk like I remove a Band-Aid. I hope to do it quick and painless as possible. I plan to speak for about half an hour about my article, then I would leave some time for questions, and we can all eat or already eat. I'm a comparativist, so to speak, and I mainly deal with comparative constitutional law and especially in the field of freedom of expression. And this is something that some people might find troubling. For example, if you're Justice Scalia, you wouldn't like this one bit. If you look at his view on the application of comparative constitutional law when trying to address domestic constitutional issues, he pretty much negates any such use. You can see this view, for example, in Scalia's opinion in Prince and elsewhere. But even those who generally favor the use of comparative constitutional law when it comes to domestic issues might be reluctant to use comparative insights when it comes to freedom of expression issues. If you were here last year when Judge Patricia Wald gave her speech when she received the Jefferson Medal, she expressed such a viewpoint. And generally, there is a phenomenon that's called American exceptionalism. It tries to examine why the U.S. actually is different in some constitutional issues than most Western democracy. For example, the best example that one can give is the capital punishment, where the U.S. is quite unique, and also most First Amendment doctrines. There is great literature on this issue, especially from Frederick Schauer, if you're interested. But if we look at all these different viewpoints regarding the application of comparative constitutional law to resolve constitutional issues, I believe that comparative constitutional law is applicable also in the realm of freedom of expression, though we have to take into consideration all the differences between the different systems. So we have to do these comparisons with great caution. Okay, so now after apologizing for the use of comparative constitutional law to resolve American constitutional issues, let's move to the fact that America is what I call exceptionally unfair. Why is America exceptionally unfair? The U.S. is probably the only Western democracy that does not have legal mechanisms such as the Fairness Doctrine that actually require a sort of balanced public discourse within broadcasting. I think it's also quite ironic because if you try to find the source of the fairness doctrine, it's actually an American source, and I think it's an example of successful First Amendment exportation overseas in the 60s through 80s. So today the fact that the U.S. is pretty much the only Western democracy that I found that does not have such requirements might stem from the successful exportation of First Amendment doctrines in the past. The only fact is that the U.S. actually changed its mind. So, what is the Fairness Doctrine? It was FCC regulation that obligated broadcasters to, and I quote, afford reasonable opportunity for discussion of conflicting views on issues of public importance. That basically meant that when you're dealing with a political issue or something that has political ramifications, you're supposed to bring more than one side of the equation. Not usually there are more than two sides, but at least you have to have some kind of balance. This is the underlying rationale behind the Fairness Doctrine. It's supposed to assure a balanced public debate. Its origins were in the 1930s, when radio actually started to evolve, and they weren't enough frequencies for all the stations, and it resulted in a cacophony. Many stations, they weren't enough frequencies, and they had to start to regulate the radio, and with the regulation rationales. You found also some regulation in the form of the Fairness Doctrine, and also a right of reply that is also linked to the Fairness Doctrine, but is more sort of a libel issue. And when someone is personally attacked, he has a right to defend himself. So, as I said, the underlying rationale behind the Fairness Doctrine was this spectrum scarcity rationale, and it was mainly, and I think to this date, it is perceived narrowly as a technical issue. There aren't enough frequencies. There's more demand for radio stations, but there aren't enough frequencies. So not everybody can express his or her opinion. Not everyone can have a radio station. Therefore, those who get concessions or get licenses to have a radio station should enable others that were not that lucky to get such a license to express their views. In my article, you can see how the Fairness Doctrine was eroded along the years, and the peak of it was in the mid 80s when the FCC decided to repeal the doctrine, and the decision of the FCC was affirmed by the Federal Circuit in D.C. in the Syracuse case in 1987. Now, the reinstatement debate is not a mere theoretical issue. There were several attempts in the late 1980s to reinstate the doctrine. Actually, Congress passed a bill to reinstate it, but it was vetoed by President Reagan. Later attempts were stifled by threats of veto by President Bush Sr. And you can see that the debate is being held also quite recently. You can see in my article references to debates held last year whether to reinstate the doctrine or not. So the question of the doctrine's reinstatement is not a merely theoretical one, but it also has practical relevance. I'm trying to ask basically two questions. The first one is, can we reinstate the doctrine? And the second is, should we do so? In order not to keep in suspense, I would answer these questions now. I think that although we can reinstate the doctrine, we should not do so. And I mainly address two issues, which is the constitutional and comparative constitutional issue, and another more economical issue of media market analysis, and I'm going to review these two starting now. Now, as I said, when we come to look at the constitutional issue, America is quite exceptional because, unlike any other Western democracy, where the fairness doctrine or such principles are not in conflict with constitutional perceptions or constitutional doctrines, in the U.S. it's debatable whether the fairness doctrine is actually constitutional or not. And therefore, usually in most other democracies, it wouldn't be a real issue. You can, in most democracies, and as I will show later, enables and actually have fairness doctrines or similar mechanisms. But at least it's not a real constitutional dilemma there. When I review the American constitutional perceptions, I address two models, and I would, if you want to know more about these models, you should read the article. I don't intend now to give an elaborate account on each model, but the two models are the absolute model as opposed to the public debate model, which is also known as the Madisonian model. To make a long story short, the absolute model, which is the prevailing model, is quite a libertarian model in its essence, whereas the public debate model or the Madisonian model is more of a progressive liberal perception of First Amendment. Now, I don't know how many of you have extensive background on First Amendment doctrines, but I guess not all of you, but since probably most of you already took or are going to take constitutional law, I think it might be helpful to think of the fairness doctrine as a kind of affirmative action for speech. I think it's very easy to think of it as affirmative action because usually the opinions that receive a proper stage are the opinions of the majority, and the ones that don't receive proper attentions are the views of the minority. So if we want to give a boost to the minority's opinions and to give them a stage, we're using mechanisms such as the fairness doctrine. Okay? So if you know the general American constitutional tendencies when it comes to affirmative action, you can understand that a libertarian approach would usually not favor affirmative action, whereas a progressive liberal approach would favor such mechanisms. So the fairness doctrine is quite inconsistent with the absolute model. It is barely justified within the confinements of this model as an exception due to the spectrum scarcity rationale. As I said, if you look at the origins of the doctrine in the 30s, and you look at the Red Line case, for example, which is the landmark ruling on the fairness doctrine from the late 60s, you can see that it is pretty much the justification behind the doctrine. Unfortunately, especially when we look at the technical aspects of this scarcity rationale, it's pretty much obsolete, especially due to technological developments. So I believe that although the court so far did not throw this this rationale out of the window, it's going to do so soon. So, and then if you look through the absolute paradigm or the absolute model, probably the fairness doctrine would be deemed unconstitutional. On the other hand, when you look at the public debate model, you would see that the fairness doctrine is actually an inherent part of its logic. And another unfortunate reality is that since the doctrine's repeal in the late 80s, and I also review this in greater elaboration in my article, you can see how the absolute paradigm got strength on the expense of the of its Madisonian rival of the public debate model. So I'm afraid that, as I said, within the absolute paradigm, it is an exception rather than the rule, and this exception is based upon rationales that are quite weak today, and they're most probably going to be repealed within, in the future. In my article, I also briefly go over some political aspects of the doctrine's reinstatement. Usually, the proponents and opponents of the fairness doctrine draw a partisan line. Democrats are in favor of the doctrine's reinstatement, while Republicans are object to its reinstatement. And I think that if you look at President Reagan's deregulation initiatives, and you understand the Republican agenda as it comes to deregulation, you can see why they would disfavor the reinstatement of the doctrine. The current administration will most probably not reinstate the doctrine. I don't think that there are any tangible odds for the reinstatement of the doctrine either under the current administration. It also has to do with the fact that I also addressed in my article that the reinstatement of the doctrine would probably not be done through the courts, but either through the regulator, which is the FCC, or through the legislature. And this has to do with institutional issues, that usually the reinstatement of such doctrines is not used by the court, because is not being done by the court because the court is under-equipped to actually revive the doctrine. And if we look at the FCC or we look at the current administration, then there are no real chances for its restatement in the near future. But let's say that then 4 years from now, Democrats get back to power, then I think that probably the chances of the doctrine's reinstatement are still very slim, because by that time the doctrine would be absent from the American constitutional scenery for around 20 years or even more. And I think that from a pragmatic point of view, you can say, well, if we can manage for 20 years without the doctrine, then we don't really need it. So as a pragmatical and political issue, I think that also there are not many chances that the doctrine is going to be reinstated, even under a democratic administration. To conclude the constitutional analysis, I would like to exit again from the American system and get a broader comparative view. As I said, the U.S. is exceptional because it's probably the only democracy where the constitutionality of the fairness doctrine is actually questionable. When you look at other European systems, you'll see that practically all of them have such mechanisms. The British call them due impartiality rules. They may be more elaborated, less elaborated. I do address this in my article in a greater length. But we can see that most other systems are what I call constitutionally indifferent to these mechanisms. While they do not prescribe them as a must, like you don't have to have the fairness doctrine or similar mechanisms, you will see that it's perfectly constitutional and there is no real contention there. And in the minority of cases, like the example of Germany, German constitutional law actually compels to have a fairness doctrine, and it would be unconstitutional not to have one. Now, I do some Cass Sunstein bashing on this point, because Cass Sunstein takes Germany and tries to make it look like it's the general rule overseas, and I think he takes the exception and try to prescribe it as the rule. But generally, you can see that even if other constitutional regimes are indifferent to the existence of such mechanisms, then still they would have these mechanisms because these issues are usually viewed favorably. Because think of it even instinctively. Who would object fairness? Who would object having a balanced discourse, a balanced public discourse? Usually, if you can have it, you're probably going to have it. Okay, now I wrapped up the constitutional aspects. Now I would like to go to the second issue that I review in my article, which is the issue of the media markets. I think that if you look at American constitutional law and say it's exceptional when it comes to these issues, well, you can say the same about the American media market. I think that the American media market is also exceptional. And it's because it's probably the closest thing we have to a free marketplace of ideas, and I'm saying this mainly because of size issues and size constraints. If you look at all other media markets, they are much more confined. Because these are small markets, the other media markets, they are perceived as limited. So the fairness doctrine is actually a means to solve this market failure because of the limited market. And I think that also the scarcity rationale alludes to this understanding of a market failure. Let me give you an example. I don't know, I never actually counted the number of broadcasting channels in the U.S., but even if you don't count them, since the U.S. market has around, I don't know, 260 million, 280 million viewers only in the U.S., the English-speaking market is even greater, and when you look at globalization and Americanization processes, you will understand that the market media also goes overseas. So it's almost an unlimited market. Whereas in Israel, for example, there are only 6 million Hebrew speakers. We used to have only one television channel between the late 60s till the late 80s, and currently we have only three broadcasting channels. Because it's such a small market, there is no place to other markets. Actually, the third channel, which is called Channel 10, and it's around 3 years old, barely sustained itself economically, and it's actually questionable whether it will be able to survive or not. So you can understand that in such a confined market, it makes sense to, you can see that there is no free marketplace, and there is no even a pretense of having a free marketplace. And where the market is so small and cannot function as a free marketplace, it justifies means of interventions such as the fairness doctrine. Now, when we look at scarcity, it's a good question, what do we mean by that? We can look at spectrum scarcity, which is probably the main understanding under American law of the spectrum scarcity rationale. But this has already been solved by technology, and although the courts didn't say so, they hinted towards this direction, and I think that within a few years there is a good chance that the court will officially abandon this rationale. If you look, for example, at satellite radio, or if you look at the number of radio stations, it's hard to claim that there is a spectrum scarcity rationale from the technological viewpoint. But if you look, for example, on the Israeli market, it's more of a broadcaster scarcity than a spectrum scarcity. You can have a spectrum for, let's say, even 100 television stations, but you can't have more than three. It's not economically viable. So, but this rationale of, let's say, more of broadcaster scarcity rather than spectrum scarcity is more applicable to non-US venues because the US market, as I said, is exceptional. But if we look at scarcity as opinion scarcity, as it, and I think it's something Sunstein alludes to in his writings, then maybe there is a room for the fairness doctrine even in the U.S. And in my article, I briefly review the American media market post 9/11, and I think that most of us would agree that the fact that there are many broadcasting channels that does not necessarily mean that there will be many viewpoints on these channels. And if we try to solve the issue of viewpoints rather than the more technical issues, then some would argue that there is too little room to have the fairness doctrine in the U.S. But as I said, but the from an economical point of view, the fairness doctrine is much less efficient in the U.S. than anywhere else. Because, for example, in Israel, when we in the mid-80s, we only had one television channel, it had a lot of strength. It had like 90% rating when all the TV shows sucked because there was nothing else to see. Right? So anything that was on these channels, since you didn't have any other venues, it would make more sense and it would be more efficient to obligate this channel to air whether a right of reply or other political views. And also today, when there are only three channels, each of these channels relatively is when we use it as the platform for reply or for rebuttal, it is much more efficient than any of the American channels, because there are so many channels here in the U.S. So in terms of efficiency, it also makes less sense to use the fairness doctrine in the U.S. rather than in most other media markets. Okay, so in conclusion, can we reinstate the doctrine? Yes, we can. But should we? I guess not. Because legal culture, basic constitutional perceptions, and market conditions that vary in the U.S. vis-a-vis other legal systems make it perfect sense not to reinstate the doctrine here while having it practically all over the Western democratic world. Thank you.